And tonight we are going to be taking Recovery Coast to Coast back east a bit and catching up with Beverly Culpain. She is the author of Dying to Be Free, a healing guide for families after a suicide, co-written by Jean Larch. And nice to have you with us tonight, Beverly.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You know, the whole topic of suicide is one that that I am very familiar with. I will share with you and with our listeners that when I came into this field of addictions back in the early 70s, I did so after a career in radio and television. I was on television doing the early news. Some people approached me from the Suicide Prevention Center. They wanted me to do a five-part series on suicide. And I said that I did not believe that suicide was a big enough problem to warrant a five-part series. They challenged me and said, give us an opportunity to prove that it is that big of a problem. They did. I did the series, and I wound up on the board of directors of the Suicide Prevention Center.
Wow.
Then went on to start a crisis intervention center that was a little bit broader and dealt more with issues involving alcohol and other drugs and living situations as well, and went on to become director of the National Council on Alcoholism in Santa Barbara, California.
Wow.
So it all started for me when some people from the Suicide Prevention Center came to me and said, let me tell you some things about suicide.
Right, because you're right, the general population has no clue.
They really don't. And you know, we talk about stigma and we talk about denial in the field of addictions. My goodness, when it comes to suicide, it's absolutely rampant.
Sure, it is. And denial is just the same. I mean,
give us an overview, if you would, of suicide in America.
Well, let me start by saying that there is a suicide every 17 minutes.
Mm.
That the people left after a suicide are called survivors, the people who are left in the aftermath of losing someone they love, and that one out of every 65 Americans officially is a survivor. Unofficially, I think it's much more than that. I think there are more survivers than we even know about.
The statistics are underreported, aren't they?
Yes, there are many more suicides than we actually know about. I mean, if some little gremlin could tell us, you know, about all the suicides we don't know about, it would just scare the heck out of us. I mean, it's already scary. But, and with youth, about every 90 minutes, somebody young between the ages of 10 and 24 kills himself or herself.
Mm.
So it really is, I mean, it's everywhere. And it's out of control.
Second leading cause of death in the United States for ages 15 through 19. That's an incredible statistic.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And college students is the second leading cause of death.
I also want to give out Beverly's website address because there's a lot of information there, Beverly, at www.livingmatters.com. I love the name of that, Living Matters, because it does matter. And
it does.
And the whole thing with suicide, and of course the connection between alcohol and other drugs and suicide is absolutely alarming.
Yes.
What are some of the myths that that people consider when they think about suicide? And I guess the first one that comes to mind to me is people who talk about suicide don't follow through.
Oh, I know it. That is. Such a lie. That is just such a myth. If you hear somebody talking about suicide, you better jump on them because it's in their mind. It's not only in their mind, they may even be planning it for all you know.
Mm.
So talking about suicide is something that a lot of people will not do when they're suicidal. But people who do should be addressed immediately.
And the connection with alcohol and drugs, 18 to 66% of suicide victims have alcohol in their blood at the time of their death.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it doesn't necessarily mean that they're an alcoholic or a drug abuser, but that they had to do something to work up the courage to kill themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the other thing that has always amazed me is accidental suicides. And by that I mean someone who makes an attempt as a cry out for help, expecting to be found.
Right.
And there was a great example of that on the television program Desperate Housewives a few weeks ago, when one of the characters took a bunch of pills, called someone and said, "Please come over right away. I've taken these pills." And the message was delayed, or she got delayed. I can't remember exactly how it happened, but the person was found dead. He did not. He was using this as a manipulative ploy to be found.
In other words, his intention was to get help, not
to
die.
Exactly. Yeah. To get help or to get attention. Right. And he was trying to salvage the relationship in this particular story.
Yeah, right? In that particular case. But, you know, when we're talking off television now, it's people who say they're thinking of suicide, or who say, oh, my life sucks, I'm going to end it all, or whatever they say, they really want help. I think right up until the very end, they're ambivalent about dying. It's not death they want. It's to be free of the pain they're feeling mm-hmm. and all the turmoil in their life. So, yeah, it's some people do. I mean, I'm in the psych field, so I've had a lot of people who do things and make and have behaviors to sort of threaten suicide. And you just have to, you never know when they're actually going to do it. So you have to pay attention to each one.
Another myth is that suicidal people are fully intent on dying.
Yeah. Actually, suicidal people do intend to die, but they don't want to die. Mm-hmm. It's not that they want to die and be gone forever. It's that they don't see any other option. They don't see any other way out. They're constantly, as I said before, once they get into the tunnel, what we call the tunnel, where they just can't think of any options outside of suicide. They're just like right in this tunnel, with the light. Then the light at the end of the tunnel is suicide for them.
Beverly Cobain joining us tonight. The book is called Dying to Be Free, A Healing Guide for Families After Suicide. It is available at the 12-Step Shop in Seattle. You can also get it online at Beverly's website, which is www.livingmatters.com. Dying to Be Free, a Healing Guide for Families After Suicide. And a nice comment on the cover from Surgeon General Satcher. This book is a masterpiece for the survivors of suicide and those who care about them. When we think of suicide, we think of the person who ultimately perhaps kills themselves. But the people left behind, the survivors, that's who this book is really intended for, isn't it?
It is, yes. It's just, and we explain in the book, there's a whole chapter on the suicidal mind. And that is so helpful for survivors. We've had a lot of feedback so far that once they can see that this was not intended to hurt any of them, or that they weren't, that it doesn't mean they didn't love their parents or their family or their friends. It just means that they were, I mean, to put it very simply now, that they just could not think outside the tunnel. Their peripheral vision was like gone. It doesn't mean they didn't love anybody. They still loved them, but they just were not in their train of thought at that time.
Beverly, talk a little bit about the guilt that goes with that. If only I had. I could have.
Yeah. You know, and that's so true. We all do that. I mean, we all do that, and you know, like we get demoted, or we lose a job that we wanted, or any, you know, lots of little tiny losses in our lives. We all think, you know, oh my gosh, if I'd only done this, if I'd only said that. But it happens to them big time, because the survivors are left with a huge hole in them, and they right away they blame themselves. They do exactly that. They say, "Oh, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have said that. I wish I had done this." But the fact is that survivors, even if they didn't know their loved one was suicidal, they did the best they could. You know, they did everything, and they probably kept them alive longer by being compassionate or by noticing certain things. But there is just tremendous guilt. Just that's one of the big things for survivors, is just crushing guilt. And it takes them a long time to get past that. They oftentimes even blame other people, like teachers or bosses or, you know, wives or husbands. And it takes quite a while to get through there, because they want to know why. You know, why did this happen? Why didn't I see this coming?
And it's obviously a tremendous struggle on the part of every family member.
Oh, it is. And some people, and another problem for families is that each person will grieve in a different way, and they'll move ahead at different times. So there might be one family member who's at the point where she gets up in the morning and thinks about it first thing, but then can move on and do some things that need to be done around the house. Well, there's another family member maybe who can't even get out of bed. I mean, it's just so it creates dissent within the household, even unless you're very compassionate about where the other people are in the grief stage.
The book, a Hazelden book, Dying to Be Free, a healing guide for families after a suicide. Beverly Cobain joining us tonight. And if the name Cobain sounds familiar to you and you're a music fan, she is the cousin of Kurt Cobain. And Beverly, if you could take us back to that morning of April 8th, 1994 for you.
Oh, it was horrible. I talk about that in the book. And it was like a day. He was the third suicide in my family. So I had lost two uncles before that and then Kurt. And I saw it coming for Kurt, you know, just watching on TV and watching his videos and watching his behavior and reading the news, et cetera. I saw it coming for him and actually spoke to his grandfather about it, who was my uncle, and said, you know, Kurt's in real trouble and, you know, you're a person he admires and I think you should, you know, we need to talk to him. And he said, well, no, this is just the way Kurt has always been. You know, so he was in great denial. You know, this is the way Kurt's always been, and when he comes back from Rome, we're going to go fishing, he and I, and I'll have a talk with him then. Well, as we all know, he got back from Rome, and 37 days later, he was dead. So,
and he had been in and out of treatment as well, and I believe he just left treatment just prior to the suicide.
Yeah, he did. And he didn't go in there really wanting to go.
Right.
I mean, really going in there to get well. He just had so much pain, and that's what it is with suicidal people, is they have so much pain, which we call psychic, you know, pain in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't, if they're not able to reduce that psychic and they get the thought of suicide, those two things are what result in suicides.
Regarding Kurt Cobain, have there been copycat suicides following that? And is that a big problem?
You know, copycat suicides can be a big problem, but they're, you know what, I was really shocked after Kurt's death. And I was so afraid because I thought, oh my God, you know, he's got millions of fans all over the world and we're just going to see so many suicides. It's ridiculous. But it didn't happen. I mean, there were one or two in foreign countries, I think. But basically, we had no copycat suicides in the Seattle or U.S. area. And I think that's because, well, I think it's complicated and I can't just name one thing, but Courtney herself, I think unbeknownst to her, spoke nationally, you know, spoke out right away, about how, you know, how awful that was that he did that to them. You know, she called him horrible names and had the listeners call him horrible names. And it was like, you know, look what you've done to me. Why didn't you just do this? And why didn't you just do that? And I think so she didn't, you know, she didn't aggrandize it. She didn't make it sound, oh my gosh, I'm so sad now. And she was angry. And she could tell she was sad, but she sort of inadvertently said all the right things. And I think that the fans heard that and thought, you know, you're right. You know, he shouldn't have done that. And then they got to see on MTV, you know, day after day after day, they got to see people mourning. And I think that was so incredibly smart to show all those people mourning, because then the kid sitting at home watching it on TV could say to himself, okay, I'm not the only one here who's sad. Look at all those people. We're all grieving. I'm not alone. So it like made it easier to not think about killing himself.
Beverly, you mentioned the anger that Courtney had following that. Is that a normal reaction?
Oh, absolutely. It's part of the grief process, and it's one of the first things they feel once they get past the shock is anger that person would do something to the people who like that, to the people that love him and the people who would have done anything to save him if they would only have known what he was going through and what he was intending to do. So there's a lot of anger.
Is that justified?
Oh, yeah. Of course, it's not only justified, it's necessary.
Mm.
I mean, you have to get that out. It's, you know, just imagine, I don't know if you've had anybody that you know kill themselves, but if there is a lot of anger there. It's like, how could you do this to me? You know, how could you do this? Look at I'll never be the same. The family will never be the same. So, yeah, it's part of the grief process and very necessary to get through on the other side of that.
There's also a myth that once a person is suicidal, they will be suicidal forever.
No. I'll tell you the truth, and I say this, and I talk about this in the book, too, that I was suicidal for an entire day once in my life, and I've never been suicidal since. I mean, I came very close to killing myself, but I didn't, and I've never been suicidal since. So, and that can suicide is like, because suicide is about pain, if something should happen to reduce the person's pain for a while, then and maybe reduce it greatly, then that those suicidal feelings can immediately go away and never ever come back.
But improvement following a suicide attempt, does that mean the risk is over?
Oh no! If a person has attempted suicide, you're asking very good questions, by the way. Once a person has attempted, they're at way higher risk for an actual suicide. That's like one of the biggest risks.
Another thing that some people think is it's a mental illness, and that it perhaps runs in families. Does suicide run in families?
Yeah, suicide does not run in families. At least there's no research to say that yet. Depression and some forms of depression do have a tendency to have some genetic factors, but they're not, just because somebody in your family has been clinically depressed does not mean you're going to be depressed. It has a lot to do, something to do with genetics perhaps, but more to do with environmental and learned behaviors and personalities and that sort of thing. And I think that's a really good point, that I think a lot of people are afraid to go get help for feeling depressed or suicidal because they're afraid somebody's going to think, okay, you're crazy, you know, you need to go here, you need to take this, and you don't have to be mentally ill to be suicidal at all.
And Beverly, if we could talk about some of the symptoms that people perhaps can look for in a suicide.
Okay, you're going to be looking for behaviors and actions. But the behavior, you'll see a change in somebody's behavior when they become suicidal, or at least when they're down enough and have too much on their plate that they're just starting to feel like they are out of control of their lives. You're going to see them, you're going to see some of the symptoms of depression, some of the symptoms of grief, but it does not mean that it is clinical depression necessarily, but you're going to see them change their behavior somehow. And usually you'll see them start drinking more or using drugs more, or if they never used them before, to begin.
Again, trying to deal with the pain.
Trying to deal with that pain, exactly, trying to get away from it. And you'll see them become perhaps more isolated or withdrawn. They're not the same as they used to be. They're not as outgoing. They're inclined to stop doing some of the things that they used to like to do. They stop hanging out with the same friends sometimes. They're more closed-mouthed. So really what you're looking for is any change in the behavior of somebody that would kind of make you think, if you're thinking inside yourself, gosh, he's different. You know, he's angrier, or he's argues more, or he doesn't come out with us as much anymore. Something's going on. All behavior means something. So I would suggest that people talk to the person and try to bring out whatever is going on with them if they'll talk about it. And a good thing to do if you think that you have a friend who may be in trouble somehow, and a lot of people don't even suspect that it might be suicidal thinking going on. So you sort of have to ask. That's the best way to find out.
It's a hard question to ask, isn't it, Beverly?
It's a hard question. It is. You know, there are very soft ways to ask it. I mean, you don't have to walk up in somebody's face and say, are you thinking about killing yourself? But you can say things like, you know, you've just seemed so different to me lately, and you seem angrier, and you won't talk to me, and, you know, you're not hanging out with us much anymore. And sometimes when people start behaving this way, they're thinking about suicide, and I want to know if you're thinking about suicide. And if they are, you have nothing to lose, because if they are, they will be so happy to hear that the subject is open. And they can talk about it. And this person who just asked that is prepared to listen. Whereas if they're not, then you'll know that. They'll say, no, I'm not thinking of suicide. What is wrong with you? But so you haven't lost anything. And you may have saved a life. And some of the other things you might see are them giving this. Now these are the late stages now, and they're getting their plan is almost ready to enact when they start giving away things that they love, possessions that they care about, and they may even say things like something that doesn't even that just sounds subtle to you, like oh, my life sucks. You know, I hate this. I wish I wouldn't even wake up in the morning. Or, you know, or other things. You won't have to worry about me much longer, you know. Oh, drive me to a bridge, I'm going to jump off. And it's like people think they're joking, and they're not. So, I mean, we've all joked about stuff like that. I mean, I even do it sometimes. But you can't afford to just let that pass by without asking about it. You need to address it. Okay, now, are you serious about that? You know, I mean, tell me now. Are you serious about what you just said? And tell me what's going on. And most people, in retrospect, they don't see the clues. They're always there, but they don't see them as having any significance until after the death. And then they can say, "Oh my God, I remember when he said this, or showed me this poem, or you know, or did that, or and I just thought he was kidding." So that happens a lot.
Preoccupation with death.
Yes. They'll have perhaps a certain. I'm talking. If you're talking about youth, they may have. They may dress in black. They may, and I'm not saying that all goth kids are suicidal, but they may dress in black. They may even stop taking care of themselves hygienically. They may. What was your question?
In terms of preoccupation with death.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I went crazy there for a minute. They have a preoccupation with death. One kid that I know who was a good friend of our family's and who ended up killing himself at 18 would sit and draw pictures of car crashes. And another child that I knew who attempted to kill himself but was saved, drew pictures of gun, you know, drew pictures of himself pointing a gun at his head. And so there were all these things going on. And he listened to a song by R.E.M. over and over and over and over in his room. And his mom felt that there was something strange about that because it was about everybody hurting sometime. It's just that song.
Sure.
But she didn't put two and two together. And I'm not blaming parents. I mean, they don't know what's going on either. So those are kind of, if you see those things or anything, you know, a poem that's about death, journalism, you know, journaling about death, a girl's diary that has a lot about death in it, that's the way they're asking for help.
If a person is, in fact, intent on committing suicide, is there anything that can be done to prevent it?
You know, there is. I mean, if you notice it, if somebody is wise enough or smart enough or lucky enough to notice that this person is showing some signs and talks to them about it and gets them some help, the whole trick, and I don't use that term lightly, but to getting somebody to back away from the option of suicide is to lower their psychic. To reduce their mental pain somehow. And that's about the only way you can get them to change their minds. Because if they've got that, and I'm thinking now of a guy who came when I worked on the psych unit, who came in one evening, and he just looked, I mean, he had that vacant look in his eye. And sometimes suicidal people will do that. They'll walk by you, or you'll go to talk to them, and you look at them, and you know there's nothing in their eyes. They're not thinking about what you're talking about. They just have this vacant look in their eyes. And sometimes it's just very quickly. But, boy, if you ever see that look in somebody's eye, just get them. I mean, you would know what I mean if you saw it. It's hard to explain how that looks. But I've seen that look many times, and I saw it in this one man's eyes this night. And I wasn't working the next day, and so I charted very carefully and said, "Watch this guy. He's really, really suicidal." And they discharged him the next day, and he killed himself. So, I mean, people who are really intent on it, until you lower their psychic, they're not going to change their minds.
What about the lethality of the different methods, the pills versus gun versus car?
Yeah, you know, some people, and you talked about this in the beginning, some people, I mean, a suicide is a cry for help. All suicides are that. Some of them just are so lethal that there's no room for rescue, whereas, and most, for instance, most kids kill themselves in their own homes after between 4 and, I don't know, 8 o'clock at night or something like that. Well, that's when people are home. So I think they choose that time, whether it's conscious or subconscious, because they know somebody's there, and perhaps they won't have to say, "I'm feeling suicidal," and have people try to argue them out of it. They'll just make the attempt and hope to be rescued. And many times they are rescued. But again, you know, males tend to choose more lethal means, and it, which is why I believe more males die than females of suicide.
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, if in terms of a cry for help, obviously taking pills is a cry for help, and, mm-hmm. and you're able to be found, hopefully, and stomach pumped and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But you take a gun to the temple, and there's not much chance of you know,
no.
coming out of it.
No, I think right up until the time that they put the gun to their head, they're hoping somebody will walk in and stop them.
Mm.
But again, in other cases, they go places where nobody could even find them. So, you know, but they do go to a favorite place or some place that is that means something to them, usually. So it's hard to say. I mean, there's just no way really to predict who is going to kill themselves. We can't use science for it, except to notice negativity in people. You know, most people who kill themselves are fun people. They're humorous. They're outdoorsy. They have lots of things they love to do. And if they stop doing some of those things and they start changing a bit, or if they've been, and I know you know this, Neil, that once somebody's been very depressed or behaving in a very depressed way for some time, and then suddenly overnight they're happy
so that's the mood swing the other way.
Yeah, it is a mood swing, and it probably indicates that they already have their plan now. They know when they're going to do it. They know how they're going to do it. They have everything all set up, so they can afford to be really happy for a while because they know it's all going to end pretty soon.
And you know, our program is about alcoholism and addiction, and oftentimes, Beverly, people with long-term sobriety. And I have a friend right now that I'm dealing with who had 24 years of sobriety and went back to drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And in talking with him, he just said the pain was so great. And he said the pain now is so great, he is fortunately going back into treatment. But he said, you know, I thought my life insurance is paid up. I can get out on the freeway. I can veer in front of an 18-wheeler. No one would ever know. And my wife would get the insurance money, and everyone would live happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
Is that common?
Mm-hmm. See, good heavens. When I first, I used to belong to AA. I mean, I don't go to meetings anymore, but I did go for 17 years. And I know that it shocked me the first 5 years I was in there, because people kept going back out again and getting drunk again, and people who were in there were having all these problems with depression, and when they talked around the tables, they talked about such sad stuff, and I know it's good to do that, I know it's good, but it scared me, because I thought, well, these people are all unhappy, and you know, and we know about working the steps in order to find your happiness and that sort of thing, but it just, they had so much pain, and occasionally somebody would take his own life, and it's very scary for people who have that much pain. And I can see how somebody with 24 years of sobriety could elect either to drink. I mean, it's almost like I'm going to drink or I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
One of the two.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
You know?
And you know, again, pulling out in front of the 18-wheeler without a note, without anything else, I guess that gets back to something I said in the first segment in terms of accidental suicides, that we may never know that it was a suicide.
There are so many of those. And by the way, about 10% of people, if that many, leave notes. So it's not if you don't know the intent of the person, again, you know, driving in front of an 18-wheeler,
mm-hmm.
how many people might do that? How many people might it be a quote-unquote fall from a tall building? You know, we don't know their intent. We don't know if they jumped. So there are just, and there are many cases like that where people drive into trees or bridge abutments,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like they fell asleep at the wheel, but, you know, because there are no brake, you know, no signs of braking
right.
or anything like that. So how many of those are suicides? We have no way of knowing. But you can sort of look back in retrospect sometimes and see that possibly was, or
mm-hmm.
looks like it really was potentially a suicide, but then families don't want to admit that.
There are psychological autopsies that are done, however, on suicide
victims. Yes, there are. Mm-hmm. There are. And if you look at the statistics, it'll say that something around 90% of people who kill themselves were mentally ill or diagnosable at the time of their death. I don't believe that for a minute. I know that depressed people kill themselves. They do. But I will not believe that most people who kill themselves are depressed. They are depressed. Certainly at the time, they have some depression going on at the time of their death, or they wouldn't be sad enough or in so much pain that they had to kill themselves. But I do not believe that you have to be diagnosed with a mental ill in order to be suicidal.
One of the things in the book that struck me was something called A Jar of Stones, and if you would share that with our audience.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like when I ask people sometimes, you know, just think of this, don't actually do it, but take a jar, like a quart jar, and fill it up with stones, and hold it in one hand, and put that arm out in front of you, and just stand there and hold that jar of stones. And in a very short time, it will be too heavy for the muscles in your arm to just let you hold it. So then I sort of ask people, now when that gets too heavy, what are you going to do? Are you going to ask somebody to help you hold it? What if you really want to keep that jar up there? Will you ask people to come and help you? Will you ask people to come and take some of the stones out, that sort of thing? Or will you just let the whole thing drop to the ground and break and shatter? And once that happens, I liken that to a suicide then, that once that happens, there's no way to put the jar back together. And people scramble around looking at the stones and trying to pick them up and figure out, you know, which one was the one that broke him. And it's done. I mean, you have to ask for help. You need to ask for help for other people, if not for yourself, for the people that love you. But it is very difficult to do that.
In recent years, we have heard, and legislation has been passed in certain states, I believe Oregon was one of them, about assisted suicide.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a different thing. That's a whole different thing. Now we're talking about somebody, and it takes two doctors to sign for it, so I'm sure they're going to be very careful. Assisted suicide will be normally somebody who is already dying and just doesn't want to prolong the pain. They're often hospice patients, that's a totally different thing than what we're talking about.
There was even a book out called Final Exit.
Oh my God, yes, there was. But you know what? If somebody really wants to die, there are lots of ways to do it. You don't have to have assistance.
Yeah.
You know.
Your book is about families and about moving on. If you would talk a little bit about support groups for survivors and how people can get. And not necessarily beyond it, but to deal with it and move their life forward.
Right. Now, because they're never going to forget that loss.
Exactly.
And they're never going to forget that person. And we don't want them to. I don't think we want to. We just want to find a place to put that person in our heart and keep it without waking up every morning and the first thing you think about is that person's death, you know? So what we espouse is getting, first of all, do whatever you need to in the beginning. I mean, you yell, scream, cry, however long and for however, you know, often you have to. Don't let anybody else tell you how to grieve, because everybody grieves a bit differently. And getting into a support group is, you know, people in recovery know that. Getting into a support group is very, very helpful, because what are you going to do with the rest of your life if this grief lasts forever? The grief period for people who have lost somebody to suicide is around 5 years, give or take, according to the person. But the first year is like just numbness and shock. They have no idea what they're going to do with their lives or how they're going to keep living. So it's really important for them to just grieve however they want to make sure they're around people who can support them, because you're not in this alone. There are, as I said, one in every 65 Americans is a survivor. So there's a lot of us out here, and they need to be able to say the things that are on their mind, even though it makes them feel guilty. Like, you know, that bastard, he killed himself and left my two children and me with nobody. And if they said that to a minister or a neighbor, they might not really be understood.
Mm-hmm.
But in a survivor of suicide group, for instance, they are totally understood. And they may need to be medicated for a while. I mean, they may need some kind of medication to help them get get along and not get stuck in the first part of grief. They may need to read, get educated about suicide and why people do it, and so there's just a lot of ways that they can go, but they need to go to one of them. You can't. And I do know a woman who stayed in bed and smoked pot for a year after her son killed himself, until finally her good friend dragged her to an SOS meeting, a survivors of suicide meeting. And now she's mourning. Before, she was just grieving. And you need to mourn, which is an action word.
Beverly, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I'm so happy to have been able to. Thank you.